Hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. We have only one appeal to hear this morning. Counsel, we're familiar with your case, and so we've read your briefs, your authorities, portions of the record, so you don't have a lot of time this morning. Get straight to the heart of your argument. You do not need to familiarize us with the background of your case. We know about it. We're probably going to have some questions, but be mindful of the clock. And when your time expires, please wrap it up. If you're answering a question from the court, of course, you can finish your answer, but do be mindful of the clock and you won't lose any rebuttal time if you have rebuttal time. Our only case this morning is United States versus Moss. Mr. Garland.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Garland on behalf of Dr. Moss. Subject to Your Honors' questions, I'll focus on two issues. First, the district court's quashing of the subpoena to Miles Hannon, the lawyer for the government's key witness, Sean Taiwan. And second, the district court sua sponte cutting off my father during closing argument in preventing him from arguing the government failed to prove Dr. Moss made a profit, coupled with the district court's erroneous jury instruction that profit was not relevant. Turning first to the district court's erroneous quashing of the subpoena, the district court erred every step of the way in both its analysis and ruling. First, by erroneously placing the burden of proving waiver on the defense. Second, by concluding that Dr. Moss did not establish that Sean Taiwan's waiver of the attorney-client privilege was intentional and not otherwise inadvertent under Rule 502. Had the district court placed the burden of proving that privilege applied on Taiwan as the law requires, Taiwan would have been unable to meet that burden.
What difference would it have made? Didn't the attorney for Taiwan back up what he said in the in-chambers examination?
And if I'm understanding your question correctly, you're asking, Did Taiwan's lawyer contradict Taiwan? Is that your question, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, actually, it's more would he have based on what he told the judge?
Yes, Your Honor. There, in fact, was a direct contradiction between Taiwan and his lawyer. And it's shown by the testimony of Taiwan. Taiwan, in line with what he previously told the government, testified, "My attorney told me not to volunteer that until it was asked, or not to reveal that until I was asked." In this quoted testimony, that Taiwan referred to was the cash payments from Dr. Moss. On the other
hand— But isn't that exactly what the attorney said?
No, Your Honor. On the other hand, Miles Hannon, had he been allowed to testify, would have testified in line with what he said in his proffer, where he contradicted the claims of his client. "My father asked Hannon, and you had not, as you've just stated, informed Taiwan that he should conceal from the government, the court, and during his entry of his guilty plea or throughout his plea negotiations, the cash."
That's not inconsistent. He didn't tell him to conceal it.
He directed.
I mean, his testimony was, at least in chambers was, his testimony was going to be that I told him not to volunteer anything. If you ask, answer. That's not concealing. I mean, I'm sorry. Maybe I was wrong for all my years of prepping witnesses, but I always tell them not to volunteer anything.
Right.
Sometimes I say don't volunteer anything unless it's helpful to my side of the case. But telling somebody
can I ask something a little more fundamental? I want to back up a little bit. I tend to agree with my colleague, but I want to go to what was actually asked and whether it would be impeaching. So this goes to the harmlessness issue, the same issue that Judge Carnes is asking about. As I understand it, the question that was asked of Mr. Taiwan at trial was, "I want to know exactly what you said when you were justifying having lied about the money about your attorney and his conduct." And the answer was, when they, meaning the U.S. Attorney's Office or the U.S. Attorney, asked, they said, "Why didn't you tell us sooner?" And I said, "My attorney told me not to volunteer that until it was asked, or not to reveal that until I was asked." And then that inquiry ended, right? That's the issue. And the question is, you want to impeach that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So how can you impeach what he testified that he told the U.S. Attorney's Office about what his attorney said when his attorney was not there to impeach that testimony? In other words, the question was not, what advice did your attorney give you? That I could understand maybe impeached, although subject to what Judge Carnes asked you about. But the question that was asked to impeach him was not, what advice did your attorney give you? It was, what did you tell the government? And he said, I told the government X. His attorney wasn't in the room to contradict what he told the government. The case agent might be able to contradict that. Maybe one of the U.S. attorneys who was in the debrief could do that. But I don't see how his attorney, who was not present on that day, could contradict that testimony.
Your Honor, he can't contradict the testimony that as to what he said to the agents, but he can very much contradict the idea, the concept that what he said to the agents was true. He could directly prove by independent evidence.
But he was never asked that question. In fact, in the lead up to all of this, the trial judge said, why do you need this? And the attorney, the trial attorney, told the trial judge, said, Judge, listen, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask him, what did your attorney tell you? And was that a lie? And if he says it's not a lie, then I'm going to call the attorney. If he says it's a lie, then I don't need to call the attorney and we don't need a rule on the subpoena. But when it came time to ask him the question, no one ever asked him, what did your attorney tell you? The question that was asked is, what did you tell the U.S. Attorney's Office? And then he was never asked, is that a lie? My question is, without those questions, what is there to impeach?
Well, Your Honor, I believe Your Honor is splitting too fine of a hair here, because first turning to the issue of whether...
You mean by actually reading the transcript?
No, Your Honor, because the fundamental issue of Taiwan claiming that his lawyer instructed him to not reveal this information came out through the testimony of Taiwan, and we needed to rebut that.
But it didn't come out. What was asked is, what did you tell the U.S. Attorney's Office? Not, what advice did your attorney give you?
And I would submit, Your Honor, that regardless of the form in which it came out, the issue came across to the jury that he did not reveal the cash because he was instructed by his lawyer not to reveal it unless asked.
Can I ask you the closing argument question? Because I want to make sure you have time for that also.
Yes, Your Honor.
So as I understand the closing argument, the quote unquote offending portion, what was said was, quote, that he had all these expenses out of his business bank account. He was paying out all this money, and this money was earned by paying $250,000. That's just the beginning. He had to pay for all these other things. And then there's no proof, not one bit of proof. And they had a duty to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. They don't prove it, you acquit. That is wrong, right? That's legally wrong. To tell the jury that they could acquit where there was more expenses than there was revenue coming in.
But no, it's long to say they had a duty to acquit. I would disagree with Your Honor that they could acquit based on that.
Well, the issue is the statement to the jury was they have a duty to prove it being profit beyond a reasonable doubt. They don't prove it, you acquit. That is legally wrong.
Correct, Your Honor.
Then why is the judge not wrong to jump in at that point and say, hey, jury, that's not the law. He doesn't have to show profit as part of the duty here, and I instruct you of that. How is that wrong?
Yeah, Your Honor, because that's not what the trial court did. The trial court jumped in and said that profit is not an issue in this case. And
right, it's not an element of the crime.
But that is not at all what the court said in its ruling, nor setting aside that portion was the overall purpose of the argument, was to establish the government's failure to prove profit. And profit, as established by the precedent of the court, is highly...
The problem is, though, the court only jumped in after whoever made the argument crossed that line to not just that they didn't prove it. I think if that was where it was left, this would be a different issue. But then they said they have a duty to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, which is not
untrue.
And if they don't prove it, you have to acquit. That is not true.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. I agree with you. But we have to focus on what the court said to the jury.
I ruled once that if the defendant made a profit or not in his medical practice was not an issue in this case. It's not an element. And that's an improper argument to argue that it is an element of the crime. And I instruct that to the jury, right?
No, I don't believe that he used the word element, Your Honor.
He didn't use the word issue, but how are we to read that anything other than the context where it comes in, where it was argued that you have to prove profit, the government has to prove profit beyond a reasonable doubt, and if they don't, you have to acquit?
Because we read it as we are raising the government's failure to prove a relevant issue, which is motive. And he did not use the word element. He did not say, did not express the duty to
counsel. Yes, motive, sir. May be relevant, but it's not a relevant issue. It's not an issue. If the judge had said, if you find the government failed to prove that the defendant had a motive to commit fraud, they don't know what his motive was, if any, that'd be wrong, wouldn't it?
I'm sorry, I just didn't understand.
Unless you find a motive. How many times have we said motive is not an element, doesn't have to be proven, but it's relevant?
And Your Honor is absolutely right. It's not an element, but we are entitled to argue relevant issues.
But you're not entitled to tell the jury that the government has an obligation to prove it.
That is correct, Your Honor. Absolutely.
That's what the district court was trying to deal with. I want to go back to Taiwan's testimony for a moment a bit. Weren't you just really trying to prove that Taiwan was a liar?
No, this was not at all general credibility impeachment, Your Honor. This was a very specific step we were taking. We were showing specifically that when Taiwan...
Your Honor, Mr. Garland, I got to jump in there because I know in your brief, you try to now say that it's to establish an MO, that was what he did when he was confronted with a lie. I get that's what you're trying to do now. But let's look at what you actually told the district court judge, because I'm looking at page 196 of docket entry 142, right before this whole thing came to pass. And the court says very clearly, if you call Mr. Hannon, what would the purpose of calling him be? And the trial attorney says, quote, to impeach the testimony delivered on cross-examination to show it's a lie. That's it. It was to impeach the testimony on cross, not to establish a motive operandi for Taiwan. If you go to the response to the motion to quash, it is unbelievably consistent with that. It says that we want to, under 608B, prove, quote, Tyrone's lies are quintessential type of deception that the jury must consider in evaluating his credibility. This was about impeachment, not about a motive operandi, right?
This is about character for untruthfulness, isn't it?
And so I've got multiple questions here, but the impeachment was a necessary step in establishing the modus operandi. And as I attempted to argue in my closing, but without the underlying proof that it occurred, that we had not been able to establish the motive operandi, I would submit this is not an after the fact, because I in fact tried to argue it in my closing even without the underlying proof. So the argument fell flat. And it is not general credibility impeachment, because it goes to establishing this specific pattern, Your Honor.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly. Is it Ms. Tessiera?
Yes, that's correct. May it please the court, Fionnuala Tessier on behalf of the United States.
Counsel, if we can, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to the things that your opposing counsel said, but I have some issues with the sentencing that I want to talk to you about.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then if we can circle back, if we have enough time, I'd like for you to respond if you need to. First, regarding the loss amount calculation, as I understand it, in a healthcare fraud case, what the commentary to the guidelines essentially say is, you know, intended loss is obviously generally going to be more than actual loss. And the way we calculated for healthcare fraud is that we treat as prima facie evidence the amount that was billed, if not rebutted, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Here, as I understand the evidence that was presented to the court for both trial and sentencing, you have a PSI which says that the defendant closely monitored his billing practices, a PSI which says that he was very familiar with the rules and codes being billed. You have Swords, the manager of the third-party billing company that left him in 2011, stating that he was more interested than any other doctor in codes and associated reimbursement, and he was very savvy about this. You have the PA, the cooperating witness, who testified that he knew what the private insurance reimbursement rates were for Medicare and Medicaid. He knew how much money then the level, each level of service would be and how much money for that level of service. He knew because the bank, he controlled the bank accounts, how much money was coming in. And his employees all said that he closely monitored the billing. And in fact, the government's entire theory here is that he manipulated the codes to increase the amount of money for reimbursement. That's the whole theory of the fraud. How is that not at least rebutted the presumption that the billed amount was the amount that this particular defendant intended? That's my question.
Certainly, Your Honor. I can't imagine a case in which a district court might find within its discretion that enough evidence of the doctor's knowledge of reimbursement codes did rebut it. But this is, I'm not aware of any case holding that a district court is required to find that the presumption has been rebutted.
Well, that's certainly true. And the loss amount is reviewed for clear error. Show me the evidence that supports the opposite inference. Show me the evidence in the record that supports the opposite inference that this defendant intended that the billed amount would be everything that he was going to collect.
Well, I would just clarify that the prima facie case itself establishes that the intended loss is the billed amount.
Agreed. And assume for the moment, and I'm only speaking for myself, that the evidence I read you rebuts that presumption. You're right, though, that we review that for clear error, the ultimate That's conclusion. Correct. So I'm asking, what evidence is there in the record which supports the ultimate conclusion?
Well, I think that the district court could reasonably infer that the defendant intended or hoped to be paid more than the given reimbursement rate at any given point in time.
Was there some evidence that the reimbursement rates increase periodically, sometimes more than annually?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. So at docket entry 185, page 126, there was evidence that the rates changed almost annually and sometimes more than annually. And so, of course, there's some reason why doctors bill more than the reimbursement rate. The question is, why do they bill more than the reimbursement rate? And what can the court infer
How does the reimbursement rate changing mean that he hoped to get the billed amount and not the intended amount? In other words, if he followed the reimbursement rates and he was billing based on the fact that some things got more money than others, then how is the fact that the rates changed affect the distinction that he intended one thing and that he intended the amount being different than the billed amount?
My understanding is that you get paid the greater of the billed amount or the reimbursement amount. And so if you bill less than the reimbursement amount, then you're not getting paid the full reimbursement amount. So if you bill if you bill $100 and the reimbursement rate changes from $100 to $110, you only get paid the $100. So one of the reasons to bill more than the reimbursement rate is so that when the reimbursement rate changes, you can get the higher reimbursement rate. To be clear, there's some inferences required there because the evidence in the record is primarily that the reimbursement rates did in fact change. But I point the court to, and I realize it's not precedent from this circuit, but the Fourth Circuit's case in Miller explains that the reason why you infer that the billed amount is the intended loss is because for 100 years, the courts have recognized that the purpose of a bill is to tell the payor how much you think that you should be paid. And that's the inference that the court is making.
Except in the crazy world of government where no one actually expects the amount that you bill to be what government actually pays out. But I get that that's the prima facie evidence. And I think for an unsophisticated party, that works. But let me ask you this. What other evidence other than the reimbursement rates changing would support the inference or evidence that the doctor intended the billed amount to be the amount of reimbursement?
I think that the cases that defense counsel cites in their case actually present exactly that kind of evidence. So they cite Moran and Semrau. And in Moran, I believe it was projected revenue documents that came from the doctor's practice that show that he in fact expected to be paid the billed amounts. And there's no evidence of projected revenue here. And in Semrau, it was testimony from the defendant to the effect that he only ever intended to be paid the reimbursement amounts. And so it's actually could be quite easy for a doctor to rebut the presumption by, for example, submitting an affidavit saying, well, I know that I billed $100, but I really
it appears to me as if he did rebut the presumption, and it's clear that you can do it based on evidence at trial. The question that for you is not whether the presumption has been rebutted, but whether there is evidence in the record supporting the district court's ultimate conclusion, finding that the rebuttal, there is other evidence supporting the intended loss amount being the actual loss amount. So you pointed to the reimbursement rates changing. What other evidence is there in this record?
Well, I think the reimbursement rates changing is the best evidence.
Is it the only evidence? Is there anything else that you could point to?
Well, I think the court can, not specific evidence, but I think the court can rely on the inferences of from why someone would bill more than the reimbursement amounts. The question of why would they do that? And I think the Miller case explains that when you bill something, you are communicating that that's what you intend to be paid.
Let me ask you a question about this. That cuts both ways, doesn't it? If you bill more, then you know under the regs that the instant that you bill it, you're going to get or entitled to get. Why doesn't that just show you're covering yourself in case the reimbursement rates go up the Monday after you send the bill in on Wednesday?
Well, I think that's right, which is why that's the intended loss. I think it's very important here that the guidelines does say that the billed amount in, and it's particular to healthcare fraud cases. So it's
I see what your argument is.
In the context of healthcare fraud cases where it is common knowledge that Medicare often will pay less than individuals bill, that is the presumption that the guidelines has put in place in Medicare cases. So it's with the knowledge that in most instances, people understand that reimbursement rates are lower. And the guidelines still places that prima facie, still says that the billed amount is the prima facie evidence of intended loss. And there is a difference between, yes,
Your Honor. Let me make sure of this. You're not arguing that if under the regs or the rates of that particular day, he's entitled to be reimbursed for a legitimate performed service of $100. And he sends in 200, you're not saying that's the intended loss, 200. You're saying the 100 is loss, correct?
No, Your Honor. We're saying that the guidelines instructs courts that the intended loss is to be based on the billed amount unless the defendant rebuts the presumption. And the question is, what does it take to rebut the presumption?
All right, but let me ask you this. Suppose you've got a doctor who actually performs a service and he's entitled under the reimbursement to get $100, but he bills for $200 and they only pay him $100. Is that an intended loss on his part, assuming it's a crime somehow, some way? Is that an intended loss on his part of $200?
The guidelines instruct that the intended loss in that case is $200. Unless see, the
problem with that is, and we've got a blurry line here between judicial notice and what we all get through the mail periodically, particularly as we incur more health costs, they always bill more than they're to do to be reimbursed.
The district court here did judicially notice that everybody knows that thing, right?
I think the district court may have mentioned it. I'm not sure if he specifically judicially.
He didn't say everybody knows that you get exactly what Judge Carnes just said, which is you bill more and you get less.
That's right. And I think it's important that the guidelines commentary still says in those facts. And again, I think it's important that the guidelines commentary is specific to healthcare fraud cases.
All right, I want to ask about the forfeiture if I can.
I'm not finished with this.
Sorry, I apologize.
This issue. So Moss didn't produce any direct evidence of his intended amount to be paid, did he? So what we really have here is that he has a general knowledge of, that he has a even sophisticated knowledge of reimbursement rates, but he didn't offer any evidence that he only wanted to be paid that amount, did he?
That's correct, Your Honor. He did not produce any evidence as the defendants did in Moran. And
there was evidence that, and there was evidence that the reimbursement rates increase, and it could be that depending on the amount of increase, you would get paid more than what the reimbursement rate had been, but it would only be up to the billed amount, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. There was evidence as to the increasing amounts. And this is a point that I think Judge Luck asked.
And then the district court only gave him 90% of the billed amount as the intended loss, right?
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, I just wanted to make sure I understood.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I would note, I think that it's not that the district court found here that the presumption had been rebutted and that the government had come back and shown right. additional evidence of greater loss. But what the district court found was that the presumption had not been rebutted. And the reason the district court found the presumption had not been rebutted is because the loss calculation that the defendant produced at trial was entirely, at sentencing, was entirely erroneous. It didn't start from the billed amount at all. What it did was it assumed how many visits Dr. Moss's.
That went to a different issue. That went to whether the services were legitimate or not, not the intent of when he sent the bills or not. That's a different issue.
Well, the defendants, I think it's important that the defendant's alternate loss calculation was faulty. And it is part of the overall defendant's lack of rebutting the presumptions that were properly applied.
The problem is that those are just different issues. I agree with you that the evidence clearly supported 10% versus what the defendant proffered. I think there were two alternate calculations and the court chose one. I don't see an issue with that. But I do want to talk to you about that with regard to forfeiture. Chief, is it okay if I ask about forfeiture?
Yeah.
Okay. The forfeiture statute says that that property shall be forfeited if it constitutes or derives from gross proceeds traceable to the commission of the offense. If the district court found, and I tend to agree that there was evidence supporting that finding, and at least by a preponderance, that 10% of the services here were legitimate services. In other words, not traceable to healthcare fraud. Then why does that discount not apply to the forfeiture amount in the same way that you discounted the loss amount and the restitution amount?
Well, I'm not sure that the district court found that 10% of the proceeds were not traceable to the fraud.
Well, it didn't make that finding, but it did find that those were part of legitimate services, which is why it discounted both the loss amount and the restitution amount, right?
They may have been legitimate services in that right. Medicare would have paid for them.
Well, then isn't that not traceable properly to the commission of the offense if they're for legitimate services that would have been paid?
No, so I point the court to the D.C. Circuit case in Burkundi.
Okay. In that case, the Burkundi case. That case, though, every billing was fraud because of the way that fraud was done. So every billing was subject to some sort of fraud. And
that's right.
I agree. I think the D.C. Circuit got it exactly right.
But
if the district court's finding here is that at least 10% of the bills were legitimate, meaning not subject to any sort of fraud, then why would that not fall within the not traceable to the commission of the offense?
And I think that's where we disagree. I don't think the district court found that 10% of the bills were legitimate. I think the district court found that 10% of the services may have been compensable, and that's different.
If the billed amount was 2.something million was the billed amount, and 90% of that was fraud, but 10% of it was actual legit services that were in fact provided and would have been otherwise compensable under Medicare, how can we say that that's traceable to the commission of fraud?
Because even the services that were, so the 10% comes from Taiwan's testimony that 95% of the services, there was nothing.
And the nurse practitioner who also provided some services, it was both.
That's correct, and the nurse practitioner. Each of those, so every single one of the nurse practitioner's services was billed under Dr. Moss's name. So every single one of those bills was fraudulent. Now, it may be that there was some value to the services that she provided, and so Medicare would have paid if it had been billed properly, but it was not billed properly. And so that's why it's
okay. That makes a lot of sense to me. Why would that not be true then for the restitution? Then why is the 10% even allowed off at all if all the bills were fraud because it was billed to the doctor. Because the testimony, as I understand it, is by billing it to the doctor, you get 15% more reimbursement than if you billed it to the PA. So why is it not all fraud then?
I think the district court could have reasonably declined to discount the restitution amount by saying that Medicare places no value on services that are billed incorrectly. But I think it's also reasonable for the district court to say, if this had not been billed fraudulently, if it had been billed properly, Medicare would have put some value on it. And so I'm going to discount the loss to Medicare by that amount.
Was
that offset?
My last question on this issue. Was there testimony from the Medicare rep? I forget his name. I think it's Cardoza or Cardoza. Was there testimony for him that if Medicare knew that the doctor was not providing the services that the PA was, even if it was a legit service, they would not have paid? In other words, who was providing the services just as material as anything else?
Yes, I'm not sure that he specifically put it that way, but there was certainly testimony evidence in the record. And I know we've cited in our brief, and it is going to take me too long to put my finger on it right this second. But there was certainly testimony that Medicare places no value on services that are improperly billed. Can claw back money when it finds out that services have been improperly billed.
Mr. Chief, that's all I have. Thank you.
Let me ask you one thing, counsel, about that. Isn't under our decision, or at least the weight of the decisions that have been made in other circuits, isn't the issue on forfeiture, where you're trying to take from the defendant the profits, not to reimburse the victim, here the government, but take the profits?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Isn't the rule that has developed that if the legitimate services amount would have been reimbursed even without the fraud, that you deduct that amount? It's a question of tracing. And haven't we said there's a but-for test? Would he have been paid for the legitimate services if it hadn't been for the illegitimate billing, the fraudulent bill? Right? Isn't that the test?
I mean, that's correct, Your Honor, in the restitution context. So the question is
forfeiture. Forfeiture.
I'm sorry. In forfeiture, the question is, would the defendant have obtained this money without the fraud?
And the answer is clearly yes, is it not?
The answer is yes, that he would have received money from Medicare, but for the fraud. I'm not sure that is correct, no.
Well, more importantly, I'm sure the district court didn't address that issue, did it? It didn't.
I don't believe.
All right, let's include in this hearing on forfeiture whether he would have gotten this money but for the fraud. I couldn't see anything in the order or the hearing or anything else that the district court touched on that. Am I wrong?
Well, I believe it is, the requirement is that the gross proceeds of the fraud be forfeited. And I think it's fairly clear that the gross proceeds of the fraud here is the amount that was paid to Medicare. And Medicare places no value.
But the gross proceeds of the fraud not include the proceeds of the legitimate services. Is gross and net, it's a profit. Get back to profit, Mr. Garland. It's a profit term. You take the proceeds, you deduct the cost, expenses, all that kind of stuff, and you get the net proceed. But that's not what forfeiture is talking about. Forfeiture is talking about the proceeds that he would have not have gotten but for the fraud, right?
So I think that maybe you are making a distinction between money that he received as a result of lying versus would he have received other money if he had not lied. And I'm not aware of any case law that says that in a healthcare fraud case under the healthcare fraud statutes, that the defendant only forfeits the money that he received from Medicare that he would not have received if he had not lied.
Is part of the answer that, because as Judge Carnes correctly framed it, it's but for the fraud would they have received it. It's a but for test. So isn't the answer that all of it is fraud, 100% is fraud, because the entire scheme, even if services were provided, they were billed to the doctor when the doctor did not actually provide those services, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So in other words, all of it was traceable to the fraud.
All of it is traceable to the fraud. That's exactly right.
In other words, from Medicare's perspective, even if I went in there and I actually changed someone's bed and checked on them to make sure they were alive, that's legitimate services. But if they billed it to Dr. So-and-so, that would be fraud, because even though a service was provided, the doctor was paid a lot more money for that service.
Right.
And all the money was 100% of the bills, right?
That's correct. If you lie on a Medicare bill,
right,
the entire amount of the bill is the gross proceeds of your fraud.
That's right.
Well, it depends. If you're talking about a but-for test, if you had not, that means but for the fraud, you wouldn't have gotten anything. And but for the fraud, he would have gotten something.
But for the fraud, he wouldn't have gotten the amount he got.
I understand.
That's why you do the adjustment, the traceable adjustment, I thought.
No, Your Honor.
What you want to do is take from this criminal the amount he got because he committed crimes. And the way I thought it was settled that you did that is you take the legitimate services that he actually rendered that didn't enrich him more than he was entitled to be enriched, and you deduct those from the enrichment that he got because of his crime, and make him forfeit the fruits of crime. I didn't think you were aiming here at punishing him in addition to the fine. You've got imprisonment, you got fine, so forth. But when it comes time to forfeiture, what you want to do is take the enrichment he got because of his crime. Am I wrong about that?
Your Honor, you're not wrong when you say you take the enrichment he got because of his crime. I think where the enrichment that he got because of his crime is the entire amount that he was paid by Medicare and by Medicaid.
That wasn't a but if amount. If he had not billed at his rate as opposed to the assistance rate, he would have gotten 85% of the amount he did. And he did that 85%, but for the crime, he got the 15 added on percent.
So as a factual matter, that's not accurate, Your Honor, because the vast majority of these services were had absolutely no value whatsoever because they were simply not medically necessary. So he would not have gotten 85%. But
I understand that. And that's what the district court is supposed to focus on and make a reasonable estimate about.
That's correct for restitution and for intended loss, but not for forfeiture. I would note the healthcare forfeiture statute does not allow a credit for lawful services rendered. Other statutes do. The healthcare fraud statute does not. I think you have to view that as intentional by Congress, that what Congress intended with the healthcare forfeiture statute is that if you lie to Medicare in order to get paid, you have to forfeit the entire amount that Medicare paid to you. That's the law. I'm not aware of a single case, and defendant hasn't cited a single case, that says that you get an offset for services that you would have been paid for if you had not lied about them. And the statute doesn't contemplate that. The statute contemplates that in other forfeiture settings, but not in healthcare.
This statute refers to gross proceeds, right?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. And it is traceable if it is traced to a bill that was the subject of the fraud. I think the district court here reasonably found that all of the bills that Dr. Moss submitted were traceable to fraud because he lied on all of them.
Well, that's a traceable
That's a traceable issue, and I'm not sure the district court's right about that. What I am more interested in finding out, and I'll do it myself, is whether health care is different from all of the forfeitures as you say it is. And it may well be, but I didn't pick that up. I didn't realize that was your argument in brief. It's your argument now, and that's good enough for me.
But, Your Honor, that's our argument in the brief. We note in our brief that the healthcare fraud statute doesn't allow an offset for lawful services. That's what the Bikundi case from the DC Circuit explains.
Yeah, we've got a lot of different language in different forfeiture statutes.
That's correct, Your Honor.
This is a 982-88A7, and it refers to gross proceeds. You've got, in some contexts, 981-A1C, it refers to proceeds. It's gross receipts under 981-A1D through E. It's gross proceeds and others. I mean, the statutes have all kinds of different terminology, but this is 982-A7, right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. Yes. Okay. And I think the Bikundi case sets this out.
Okay. Any other questions of Ms. Tessier? She did not. We didn't have any questions for you about Mr. Garland's arguments. I'm not sure that you need to say anything about that, but if you have anything further, I'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just note that I think the district court did not abuse its discretion in any of the evidentiary rulings or in the exercising its discretion to limit closing argument. I would say even if there were some error, the evidence against the defendant here was just simply overwhelming. And so any error would have been harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, given the overwhelming evidence against the defendant. And if there are no more questions, I'm well over my time. So we will rest on our briefs.
Well, you were on our time because we had a lot of technical questions for you. And Mr. Garland's probably going to be given extra time to the extent he needs it to address those kinds of questions, many of which were beyond the scope of his opening arguments. Thank you. Mr. Garland.
Thank you, Your Honor. Turning to the issue of why bill more than Medicare allows, there are plenty of other reasons for that other than intent to receive up to the billed amount. For instance, one reason would be someone bills an amount for both private insurance and Medicare, where the reimbursement rates would be different. And so you would want to keep the same billing structure for both, knowing you're only going to be reimbursed at the rate.
Is there any evidence, though, that your client actually intended to receive less than the billed amount? And I understand that he knew about the reimbursement rates, and he would have also known that the reimbursement rates can increase. And he could be paid up to the billed amount in the event that there was an increase in the reimbursement rate after he billed the government. But is there any evidence that, other than his knowledge of reimbursement rates, that he actually intended to receive only the reimbursement rates?
Your Honor, there's no direct evidence that Dr. Moss told me his intent in submitting this bill was to receive the reimbursement rate.
But there's also not the sort of thing that you had in, what was the case?
Moran
case, where there's any kind of internal documents that show that his intent was only to get some lesser amount.
Yeah, yes, I don't believe there's a document like that, Your Honor, but certainly Moran doesn't set that out as a necessary condition.
I'm not saying that. I just wanted to know what we have here.
And Your Honor, I would ask you to focus, though, on the evidence, the extensive evidence the government put in of his knowledge of the billing rates. To have that knowledge and then engage in the steps of billing is all the proof we need to show that he intended to receive the reimbursement rates. It's just like any other case, an assault case where you know the act you're doing is dangerous and then you do it. You're guilty of the underlying crime. This is the same type of thing. He was so aware of what the reimbursement rates was. To submit a bill in and of itself is proof that he intended to receive the rates that were allowed, because he knew all that he would receive would be the rates that were allowed.
He knew that might be all. But if the reimbursement rates can change even more than annually, and that you would receive in that event up to the amount billed or reimbursed or the new reimbursement rate, whichever is greater, then the record also allows an inference that he would have wanted at least the amount he billed, right?
I don't agree, Your Honor, because there's no evidence in the record to show that the rates ever increased up to the level of the billed amount. There's no evidence of that at all. At the most, there would be an increase between the difference of the current rate and the new rate. And that still does not get Your Honor all the way up to the billed amount. It only gets you this marginal increase.
Depends on what the new reimbursement rate is, doesn't it?
Yeah, but there's no evidence whatsoever.
You wouldn't be paid more than the billed amount, would you?
Correct, Your Honor. But there's no evidence whatsoever in the record, Your Honor, that the rates ever increased on that nature. The billings were many times higher than the reimbursement rates. I would submit to be in line with the private insurance billing. And there's no evidence they ever increased up to the billed rates. The government didn't put in one piece of evidence to show on this occasion the reimbursement rate increased to at or above the billed rates. And to say that might be enough is mere speculation.
So you think that mere knowledge is enough to require the district court? It'd be clearly erroneous for the district court to have found that the presumption had not been rebutted.
Yes, I mean, whether it's through just judicial notice or the evidence presented at trial, that it was overwhelming knowledge of the rates, and billing those rates, it absolutely, the presumption is rebutted. Turning to the court's discount of 10%, that 10% was based on the testimony of Sean Taiwan's one comment from Sean Taiwan. It's not based on any meaningful assessment of the evidence showing what services provide.
Taiwan's testimony was that 95% of the visits were medically unnecessary, right?
Your Honor, I may be misremembering the testimony, and I don't have it in front of me.
I think you're both right. I think he testified up to 95%, but I think the district court probably just, let's be careful, doubled that and got 10%.
Right.
And you know, we also, as pointed out, we have to include the services of the nurse practitioner. We have to include, you know, we put forth extensive evidence at sentencing about all the other necessary services that would be required to keep these people alive, to keep them cared for, to keep, you know, we put in the evidence that their life
counsel, with regard to that, there was contrary evidence. And I understand that you put in the evidence that this would have had to have happened or could have happened, but there was evidence that 95% was illegitimate. The district court clearly tacked on some extra because of the nurse practitioner and rounded out. And as I understand the guidelines, all that's required is a reasonable estimation when you do this. So I just, it's hard for me to see that that's clear error, even where there's contrary evidence. If you could focus on the forfeiture issue, as I understand the government's argument, the reason why all bills are traceable to the fraud is because that all bills were made to Dr. Moss, and Dr. Moss in all instances did not provide those services. Is that fair?
I believe that's what the government's argued. Yes, Your Honor.
Right. Then why is that wrong, that it would not all be traceable then to the fraud? If the fraud is defined, as I understand it to be, that part of, or at least a big part of the fraud was that you billed to a person who did not provide that service, that is a material fact, and it led to a higher reimbursement rate.
But Your Honor, I would submit that the value of these legitimate services have to be accounted for, because they don't go to any type of core conspiracy here. They are services that are being provided for these patients.
But if Medicare determines it to be material on who provides the service, and the service is not provided by that person, then what does it matter if they actually got a fluffed pillow or a new blanket or you know, checked to make sure that the oxygen levels were appropriate? What does it matter if the wrong person is doing it and Medicare is billing based on that material information?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, if that were the rule, then if that were the exception, that exception would swallow the whole, because there would never be an analysis of what services were provided, because in every Medicare fraud case.
Isn't this the statute and how it's worded? The court, in imposing sentence on a person convicted of a federal health care offense, shall order the person to forfeit property, real or personal, that constitutes or is derived directly or indirectly from gross proceeds traceable to the commission of the offense. I don't understand how it is that that's not satisfied here.
Your Honor, because it doesn't account for the legitimate services that were provided.
It says gross proceeds traceable to the commission of the offense.
And I would submit that proceeds that were obtained for legitimate services are not traceable to the commission of the offense.
But how can the services be legitimate if they were billed to a doctor who did not provide those services? And everyone agrees, at least there's some evidence, that 100% of the bills were made to a doctor who did not provide the service. It can't be legitimate, right?
Yeah, who it was billed under was not correct. It was incorrect billing, right. But the services themselves were very much legitimate.
That's what I said. What does it matter? I mean, what if they hired the janitor to do what the doctor allegedly have done? What does it matter?
That's not something you can bill for under Medicare, Your Honor. What the services were rendered were very much billable and reimbursable under Medicare and legitimate services. These patients received great care. Witnesses were put up to testify to that care. There was testimony that the life expectancies of the people was extended.
Well, counsel, I'm not going to get in that with you because those are just very much disputed issues. But at least with regard to this, when we're talking about traceability, it seems to me that 100% of the bills were traceable to what the alleged fraud was. Because remember, it's traceable, gross proceeds traceable to the offense. If the offense here is billing for the doctor who did not actually provide those services, then it would seem to me that 100% is traceable to that.
And I understand your position, Your Honor. I would say that there is a carve out for the legitimate portion of that because it is not part of the conspiracy to provide the legitimate services.
It all depends on the definition of traceable, does it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I thought there was a but-for test, but then I guess it depends on what but-for means and maybe what the offense means. Were the gross proceeds for a particular fraudulent billing? He said he did it. He got 85% instead of the other, or he got 15 more percent. He said, I did this. And in fact, he didn't. Is the 85% of that traceable to the commission of the offense, or is the gross proceeds, the entire 100% of that one billing, traceable to the commission of the offense? That's the question, isn't it?
I agree with Your Honor.
He submitted a bill, and he gets the amount, right? But for that bill, he wouldn't have been paid that amount, the gross amount, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but I would submit that the analysis is not that simple, because
that's the way I thought but for worked. But you know, I've had debates with colleagues about but for before.
Yes, it is one of those terms that is subject to different interpretations. Absolutely, Your Honor. And I would submit, as I've stated, that it does not include those legitimate services that would have been billed properly under Medicare.
I think we understand your argument, counsel. We've gone a fair amount over. There are a lot of issues in this case, and particularly some complicated guideline and other sentencing issues. And we very much appreciate your help this morning. We'll be in recess until tomorrow morning.
All right. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.